welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. In 1961, Clarence Earl Gideon, a drifter with an eighth-grade education, was arrested in Florida for breaking into a pool hall and stealing money, a crime that he was later found not to have committed. Because he was too poor to hire a lawyer, he represented himself in court and was sentenced to 5 years in state prison. From his cell room, he researched his constitutional rights and filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, relatively speaking, Gideon got lucky. In 1963, the Supreme Court eventually heard his case, Gideon versus Wainwright, and ruled in Gideon's favor. Justice Hugo Black wrote, "Reason and reflection require us to recognize that in our adversary system of criminal justice, any person hauled into court who is too poor to hire a lawyer cannot be assured a fair trial unless counsel is provided for him." And so began the practice of assigning public defenders to all defendants accused of a crime who could not afford a lawyer. But more than half a century now since the Gideon case, is the public defender system working? Are poor people getting the legal representation and speedy trial they are guaranteed in the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution? Today, we're going to talk with two public defenders to hear what goes on behind the scenes. And joining us in studio is Jeff Adachi, who's the public defender of the City and County of San Francisco. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Holly. Great to be here.
And before being elected as public defender in March of 2002, Jeff Adachi worked as a deputy public defender in San Francisco for 15 years and in private practice for 2 years. And we're also joined on the phone, from the studios of KUSP, by Lawrence Bigham, who is the public defender in Santa Cruz. And he started public defending in Santa Cruz County in 1972. And the law firm Bigham, Christensen, and Minsloff has provided indigent defense services to Santa Cruz County since 1974. Hi, Lawrence.
Good morning, Holly. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
And I'm going to go ahead, before we get going into the conversation, and give out the phone number for listeners to join our conversation. If you're an attorney or if you've had experience being represented by a public defender, let us know what that experience was like. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What does the Sixth Amendment mean in practice? What is justice if you're footing the bill? And how do you look at that same equation if you're on trial? The number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. And you can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So here we are in this state that pioneered public defense 100 years ago in 1914 in Los Angeles. Why don't you give us a little context about how this whole system was developed and this fascinating character of Clara Shortridge Foltz, who was the first female attorney in California, yeah.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, Holly, it was the Gideon decision where the Supreme Court first said, hey, by the way, you know, if you live in this country, you have a right to a lawyer. But the irony is that we've had a right to counsel. It's in the Sixth Amendment of our Constitution, which was the Bill of Rights passed in 1791, where it says in this remarkable document, if you're charged with a crime, you have a right to a lawyer. But they never said who was going to pay for it.
Hmm.
And so we've had this really crazy history in this country of not properly funding this constitutional right. And so it wasn't until 1963 where the court said, you know, we're going to give a right to everyone charged in a felony case. And then later there was another case that allowed it in misdemeanor cases. But prior to 1963 in this country, unless you were charged with capital murder, which is a death penalty offense, you had two choices. If you couldn't afford to hire a lawyer, you either represented yourself or you pled guilty.
Well, and then Clara Foltz came along, and she was the big advocate for creating a public defender
system. Well, see, that's a crazy thing, is that in our office, for example, we've been around since 1921, and people are like, well, wait a minute, that was way before Gideon. How did that happen? And it's because of Clara Foltz. Clara Foltz was the first woman attorney in California. She was a single divorced mother of four, lived in San Jose in the 1870s, and decided that she wanted to go to law school and become a lawyer. Well, there was one problem. Women could not become members of the state bar. And so she apprenticed for a lawyer, learned how to change the law, and pushed for a change in the law that said only white males could become members of the state bar. And she changed that to person, which allowed not only women but minorities to become lawyers. But as a result of that, she became a criminal defense attorney. You know, she was very prominent. And In 1893, he introduced the idea of a public defender's office. He spent 21 years advocating for a public defender's office, and in 1921, it passed.
It's such an extraordinary story, and I didn't know about it before researching this. So in 1963, the Supreme Court case passes Gideon. How did Gideon transform the legal landscape after that?
Well, it took what we had in California, and it applied it everywhere. So you saw public defender offices or private defenders who were contract lawyers sprouting up all over the country. Today we have over 15,000 public defenders and thousands of private attorneys who provide services to people who can't afford lawyers. And so in California, for example, we have, 52 different counties. Larry handles all the cases for Santa Cruz. It's county by county system. But, we still suffer under the lack of resources. In this country, public defenders are treated like the stepchild of the criminal justice system. There was a study by the Brennan Center that showed that nearly $6 billion is spent on prosecution, and about half of that, $3 billion, is spent on indigent defense. So that there's something wrong when, one side has half the resources that the other side does.
And does that equation hold true here in San Francisco?
Well, we've really had to fight. When I started in the public defender's office almost 30 years ago, I used to have 300 clients at any given time. I mean, you can imagine that, being responsible for 300 clients. I mean, I worked harder than I've ever worked. We used to go to work at 6:30 in the morning, prepare for court in the morning. You'd handle 50 to 75 cases in the morning. Then in the afternoon, you'd try cases, and then you'd come back, and there'd be 15 new clients in your box. And you did that 7 days a week. Now, one of the things that I did when I came in as public defender is that I set caseload standards. And so now my attorneys are limited to a certain number of cases.
What's that limit?
Well, it's about 70 cases in misdemeanor cases. And in felony cases, where we used to handle 100 cases per lawyer, it's about 40 or 50.
Huh. Interesting. And let's bring Lawrence Bigham into this. You've been the public defender in Santa Cruz County since 1972, which is less than 10 years after Gideon. What have you seen in this 4 decades that you've been in office? What kind of transformation and ups and downs and challenges have you seen?
Well, back in 1963, although I was in Chicago at the time, I don't believe Santa Cruz County even had a public defender's office. It was sort of a rural, they called it a cow county at the time. And so when Gideon came down, they just let a contract out to a private law firm. And I think many small counties have done that. One of the challenges, I think, of Gideon in California is it's an unfunded mandate from the Supreme Court. 28 states have taken over that responsibility, but in California, they've delegated or dumped that unfunded mandate onto the counties, and the counties have responded in several different ways. There are some excellent public defender's offices in the state, and then there are some that are really underfunded, and the caseloads are, frankly, unconstitutional, excessive. But in Santa Cruz, we were small. I came in 72 and worked for Gary Brinton and Jim Jackson. And then after some serious homicides, Mullen, Kemper, and Frazier, which were, we were then the murder capital of the world, I thought, they gave it up and I took it over in 1975. Our budget then was $150,000 and now it's about $5.7 million. But the DA's is $13 million, so there is that continuing disparity in our profession.
And what kind of caseloads do your public defenders handle?
Really the same as San Francisco, although we have different delivery systems, we have the same commonality of clients and challenges, and our staff is committed and caring. In Santa Cruz, we have a lot of drugs, but the same themes, I believe. You have poverty, you have addiction, you have mental illness, you have homelessness, and you have some crimes of violence as well. But I don't think our county has a monopoly on bad behavior.
And let me ask both of you what you think are the biggest challenges in your job today, and also what keeps you in the game, what keeps you doing this work. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I mean, public defense is really a passion. And for the 90 attorneys in our office, they do what they do because they believe in fighting for justice for the everyday person. And so I don't want to give the listeners the idea that, you know, somehow being a public defender is a horrible job. It's really a great job. But you're constantly strapped for resources. You are going to be handling, you know, way more cases than a lawyer in private practice. And, you know, you have to be the type of lawyer who finds your inspiration in, you know, providing the very best service or better service than the client could get if they could hire a lawyer. So that's really what motivates us every morning. But, you know, we're able to affect outcomes for people in their lives. If you win an acquittal in a case or you get a good outcome, even as a result of a plea bargain, it makes a huge difference in people's life. I just saw a client who I represented, and let me tell you, Holly, this client had gone through multiple drug programs. He was looking at a 20-year sentence, and, you know, it seemed like there was no hope for him. And we were able to get him into a program, and now he's a recovered addict. He's been clean for 25 years. He's taking care of his family. He's an electrician. And so when you see that as a lawyer, it you know, it's very gratifying and rewarding, and that's why we do what we do.
How about you, Lawrence?
I think this job isn't for everyone, and I know Jeff would agree with that. You need people who have the passion, the commitment, and the care. I like representing the little people, the underdog, if you will, and I also like representing the Bill of Rights. We represent that fragile border between the right of the police to police and the right of its citizens to be left alone. And that struggle is fought on a daily basis in our criminal courts, one case and one client at a time. So in some sense, we're public constitutional law enforcers to make sure that the state and its police and its prosecutors and its judges don't take constitutional shortcuts when they try to secure a conviction. But I like representing little people who need our services and whose lives we can affect and touch.
And let's go to Meg in Salinas. Hi, Meg. Welcome to your call.
Hi. You know, thank you very much for taking my call, and I'd like to thank both of those public defenders for doing a great job. And I can tell you that Santa Cruz, I do have good things to say about Santa Cruz. I live in Salinas, and I've been following what's been going on with the public. This is, again, you talked about passion. This is a passion for me, and that is looking after people who don't, most of the time they don't know their rights. And I find that the police or that the system in itself feeds off of the ignorance of the public not knowing their rights, and they intimidate the public. The court system, they corral a lot of these people right through. Now, in California, it seems that because that they're really trying to stop locking people up who are going in for drugs or other non-offensive type violent offenses, in Salinas, lately we've had a couple of shootings. We just had one last night. The police here seem to be going rogue, just like they've done in Albuquerque. Last night there was a shooting of a person who was actually backing away from police officers, and there were a lot of citizens there who pulled up their cell phones and took pictures, and that's gone out on the internet. And I'm really incensed. I myself met with a lot of residents in this area who don't know what to do. They fear the police officers. They don't feel that the system represents them in any way. And so not only are they locking people up for not having the money to defend themselves or money to pay the debts that are owed to the county, it would appear that the police have just gone to the point where they are becoming judge and jury, not even bothering to taking people into the courtrooms and shooting them like dogs in the street.
Thanks very much for calling, Meg. Do you have a response for her, Jeff?
Yeah, thank you for calling in, Meg, and sharing that experience. And I think it is so important that when you're dealing, you know, with an issue like how the police are responding to a particular crime or investigation, that, you know, that people understand that this happens all the time, where the, you know, police may be responding to a bona fide situation, but they overreact, or they, like you said, go rogue. And that's where public defenders come in. It's our job to ensure, in a sense, that the police follow the rules. when the police violate a person's constitutional rights, it's our obligation as public defenders to raise that in court. And we file motions to, in some cases, suppress evidence, to establish that a constitutional right has been violated. And the first thing I would do is look to see what procedure in your county there is to make a complaint against police misconduct. There should be some agency involved. Often these agencies are ineffective or themselves have very little power, but it is important to report it. The second is talk to the media about it. And, you know, these stories are important for people to know. And the last thing is, you know, talk to the public defender's office. In San Francisco, we had a situation where police were going into residential hotels without search warrants. And we learned of this through our clients, and nobody would believe them. The judges would believe the police always over the residents who were saying, hey, these officers are coming to my room, searching it without a warrant. Well, we sent an investigator back to the hotel, and they had a very sophisticated system of surveillance cameras. So we downloaded a year and a half worth of videotape, compared that to police reports filed by the police under penalty of perjury. In every instance, it showed that the police were lying. And so, you know, you might have read 2 or 3 months ago that a number of police officers were indicted for that. But that's part of what public defenders should be doing, is guarding against those kinds of abuses. One of the things that sometimes I like to say is we're the only government agency that's paid by the government to fight the government.
That's Jeff Adachi. He's the public defender of the city and county of San Francisco. We're also joined by Lawrence Bigham, who started public defending in Santa Cruz County in 1972. He's the public defender of Santa Cruz County. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the right to a speedy and fair trial, the Constitution, and how our justice system actually works, with a focus on how it works for low-income folks. And we want to invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What basic level of legal representation should someone have the right to? Is our public defense system working as is? Is it underfunded? And if you're an attorney who's had experience in the system, or if you're somebody who's been a public defender or a prosecutor, call and tell us about your perspective. 866-798-TALK. You can also send us a note to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Lawrence, you said that you feel like your job is essentially representing the underdog and the Bill of Rights, but you've both said that you're essentially underfunded. Do you think that it's a lopsided battle?
Sure, but we knew that going in. I mean, everything in life is compared to what? And I think compared to most public defender systems, we're relatively well-funded in Santa Cruz. And if you go over to the Central Valley, and I know this because I just interviewed a job applicant from Fresno, he has 250 or 300 misdemeanor files right now open. That's not right. So could we use more resources? For sure. But when you're in a system like some of these counties in the Central Valley that are, I think, unconstitutionally underfunded, clients aren't being seen, motions aren't being filed, investigations aren't being put out, and cases aren't being tried. And that's not a healthy system. I mean, that may serve the purposes of the district attorney who wants convictions or the judge who wants to move files, but it doesn't serve justice. And so I think the best way to ensure that we don't get wrongful convictions is to have a well-funded, well-prepared advocates on both sides of the aisle in a courtroom to ensure reliable and fair outcomes. And when we have wrongful convictions, not only are people unfairly convicted, but the actual perpetrators continue to commit crimes. So I think reliability, fairness, and public safety require well-funded advocates on both sides of a criminal courtroom.
And Jeff, can you describe the process that a defendant goes through to get a public defender to, and how much time do they get to spend with this representative?
Well, there was a study recently out of the Brennan Justice Center that says on average clients spend like 6 minutes, you know, with a public defender, which is crazy.
That's outrageous.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what happens. It becomes a plea bargaining mill where you have a lawyer who's got 300 cases and they can't even keep the names of their clients straight. And there is something that's called the 10 Principles of Indigent Defense by the American Bar Association. And what it talks about is that, you know, you have to be able to develop a relationship with that client. Now, the way public defenders are appointed in most counties is that there's a determination made that the person is, in fact, indigent. Indigent means that the person is poor, cannot afford a lawyer. But, you know, lawyers are so expensive right now. You can, you know, be charged $300 to $500 an hour if hiring a private attorney. And so if you can't afford a lawyer, then the public defender is appointed, and you're just going to get, you know, whatever public defender who is assigned to that courtroom. It's worth pointing out that it's not this way like it is in the United States everywhere. I met the public defender in London, and he told me this: the way the system works there is that if you wanted to walk into Morrison Forster, which is one of the premier law firms in the city, hire a lawyer there, then the state pays for it. And it costs, I said, well, how much do you spend on indigent defense in, or public defense in the UK? He goes, oh, it's about three times as much as we spend for the prosecution. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, the prosecutor's always complaining, but that's the price of providing equal justice. So it's not that way everywhere. And here, I think it is criminal that you have public defenders. In Washington State, for example, you had felony attorneys there that were handling 500 felony cases a year. And the results are, in that county, what happened was is that a person was wrongfully convicted. They were sentenced to prison for a year. They sued the public defender. And there was like a $3 million verdict. So convictions are reversed. You know, as Larry said, if you get the wrong person because of lack of reliability, it results in a system that's broken and that doesn't bring people to justice.
What kind of recourse do you have if I get appointed a public defender and I read one case where the public defender was drunk and asleep during a trial of a man
Texas,
who was actually...
Right?
No, it was in San Mateo County where...
San Mateo.
And he was wrongfully convicted, spent 12 years in prison and then got out. But what kind of recourse do you have if you're the defendant? And oftentimes these are very low income, sometimes not well-educated folks.
Well, if you are represented by an incompetent lawyer and you can prove that, and that's the hard thing, being able to actually prove that the lawyer was incompetent, you know, then you might win an appeal. But it's very difficult to prove incompetency of a lawyer. And even if you are able, because the standard is, you know, does the lawyer's performance rise to sort of the average of what would be expected of a lawyer? But even then, it's subject to what's called a harmless error. And so long as a prosecutor can show that, oh, it really didn't contribute to the outcome that much in your case, then it's going to be forgiven. So, you know, there's really not a penalty in most cases where you can show your lawyer's been incompetent.
We're talking
about... It's really difficult.
I'll get right to you right after the break that we're coming up on. We're examining the efficacy of our criminal justice system, and we're specifically focusing on the rights of the accused. We're speaking with Jeff Adachi, who's the public defender for San Francisco, and Lawrence Bigham, who's the public defender for Santa Cruz. And Lawrence, I'll get to you right after this break. The number to call to join our conversation is 866-798-798. Talk. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And again, the number is 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Many ways to take part in today's conversation. You can send us an email. The email address inbox or inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today, the story of many people have died in attacks on two villages in northeast Nigeria following yesterday's double bomb attack in the central city of Jos, which left more than 100 people dead. The group Boko Haram is being blamed. The BBC says the ferocity, frequency, and geographical spread of the attacks is alarming. Where is Nigeria heading? We'll hear that coming up on World Have Your Say at 11 here on Local Public Radio.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the history of Monsanto and its effect on the food system. Friday is our weekly media roundtable, where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're examining how the public defense system works, and we're speaking with public defenders about representing the poor. It's been more than half a century since the Supreme Court ruled that every defendant in a criminal case deserves legal representation, even if they can't pay for it. But many public defenders are overworked and underpaid. So how does that affect justice and what needs to change? We are joined by Lawrence Bigham, who's the public defender of Santa Cruz County, and Jeff Adachi, who's the public defender of San Francisco. And right before the break, Lawrence, I'm sorry, you wanted to weigh in there, so please do.
I wanted to support Jeff. To get a reversal on ineffective assistance of counsel is nearly impossible. The Supreme Court in 1984 in the Strickland v. Washington case, in effect, lowered the bar and made it extremely difficult to challenge convictions. The Supreme Court seems to be more concerned with finality than fairness. I mean, the test was – it's impossible to meet in reality. The court has declined, as you knew, Holly, and mentioned it. They didn't find an attorney ineffective in Texas who literally slept through portions of a trial. Another case, a lawyer used heroin and cocaine throughout the trial, and no ineffective assistance was given in that. There's another case where a lawyer said before trial that he didn't know the facts nor the law, and after the conviction, IAC wasn't given any weight in that instance. So the Supreme Court, by lowering the bar, has made it easier for funders to defund public defender delivery systems because they're not subject to litigation and lawsuits very easily. And I think that's a real problem in our industry.
And let's go to Jane in Marin County. Hi, Jane. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning to all of you. I'm a volunteer at San Quentin and have been going there for over 10 years. And I've been familiarizing myself with the law regarding the death penalty. And I'm curious to know, or maybe I know, maybe I don't, but the public doesn't understand why it takes, and the executions are on hold in California, and we won't even go there about that. But the public doesn't seem to understand why it takes so long to execute a condemned prisoner. Could you go in a little bit into the history of the automatic appeal and the appeals that follow, and do public offenders defend condemned men, et cetera, et cetera?
Thanks very much, Jane. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that's an excellent question, because one of the reasons why these cases take so long is because there aren't lawyers to defend them, or the resources for defenders who do these cases, death penalty cases, which obviously are the most complex, difficult cases, are severely underfunded. These cases are usually farmed out to public defenders or private attorneys who handle these cases. And as you can imagine, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of work. And for years and years in this state, and this is true nationwide, these lawyers are inadequately compensated and don't have the resources. So that is, clearly one of the reasons.
And a lot of law firms, though, will take on a death penalty case pro bono, which isn't the case in other kinds of appeals, right?
That's happened, but we can't rely on, sort of the goodwill of, private firms. They might take a case here or there, but they're not going to certainly, take most of the cases. And, there have been some states that have suggested that somehow, these cases should just be farmed out to lawyers to do for free. But it's a tremendous obligation, and it takes a lot of resources to handle one of these cases. So if they're going to seek the ultimate punishment against somebody, death, they need to fund the cost of the defense. And as we know, in California, I mean, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on a death penalty that's ineffective. And one of the arguments that has been used to say, let's get rid of the death penalty, is that all the legal costs which come with defending a death penalty case would be substantially reduced if we had life without possibility of parole.
And let's go to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to Your Call.
Hey, good morning. Quick question. Can you, for Mr. Adachi, is there any standard that he applies for his attorneys to return calls and communicate with clients? I've had experiences where the communication's horrible, but the client facing charges is really in a desperate situation where they cling to any port in a storm. So I'm curious if there's any standards for that. And the other thing is, the prosecution cheats. Any comment on how either discovery is withheld or witnesses are made to lie? And this is by, people paid by the city or the counties that they're in. They're public servants, and yet they lie when they're prosecuting people. Any comments on that, and how investigators help public defenders really find out what's going on to represent clients?
Let's get a response, Ken. Thanks very much for that.
Yeah, Ken. Well, I hope the experience that you're talking about wasn't with our office. We do have standards in place. We require our attorneys to meet with the client within 48 hours of our appointment. Once they're appointed in court, they have to meet with the client within 48 hours if they're in custody. If they're out of custody, then, normally we'll set the initial interview around the client's schedule. But that's so important that we listen to the client, that we're not judgmental, that we fully investigate each case. We have an obligation to perform an independent investigation. And often, we learn things that the police miss, that they overlook. And you mentioned the right to discovery. Discovery is, whatever evidence the prosecution has. And we are entitled to that under law. And we do have problems with prosecutors hiding information. I had a murder case where the prosecution hid an entire box of evidence which would have exonerated my client. And in that case, my client was convicted of murder. We continued to work on his case for 7 years. A private firm came in. John Kecker's firm came in and represented him. And he was finally released. But the city was sued for $4 million. But, that's what happens when evidence is withheld. So that's very important. But, again, it is so critical that public defenders take the time to listen to the clients, to meet with the clients, fully investigate the case. And if you ever are in a situation where the lawyer's not doing that, you should report that to the public defender, the official.
And, Lawrence,
Could I jump in, Holly?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you.
The caller has one of the common problems with public defender lawyers is that we're always in court. We have high volume cases. And I think we're very good because that's what we do, and we do it well. But client contact is a challenge when people are in jail or they're in the community and we're always in court, which is why caseloads need to be reasonable so that we can give the clients the respect and the time that they need. I analogize it to we're Costco, we're not Nordstrom's, and we give good product, but we can't give the customer service and the hand-holding that perhaps a private law firm could. On the other hand, we know what we're doing, and we give good product for a good price.
Well, and if we look at this Brennan report saying that on average a public defender is spending 6 minutes with a client, how could that possibly be a good legal counsel?
That can't be. I'm sorry, Jeff. That's sort of a meet 'em and plead 'em, and that's not acceptable, and we certainly don't tolerate that in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I mean, what a relationship means is that the client trusts you, that you've taken the time to communicate with the client. We require our attorneys to return all phone calls within 24 hours, and when we meet with the client, the initial interview is to find out background information about the client, to find out what happened, to get to know the family. And we also require our attorneys to communicate, with the family, just as you would expect if you were in private practice. And then from there, as there are new developments in the case, you have to communicate every offer that's made in the case, all the investigation that you've done, and you have to instill confidence in your client. And that takes time.
And a listener who couldn't stay on the line wrote in saying, can you respond to the fact that some counties are now charging defendants for public defenders? And I think she might be referring to this excellent series that NPR has done all week, really looking at all these fees that are keeping people in this cycle of jail and debt.
Yeah, I mean, and if people get a chance to check out the series, they really should, because they would be shocked. In 43 states, including California, there are statutes that allow the courts to essentially charge for public defender services.
And charge you for staying in jail.
Yeah, and it's like it's what they call public defender fees. It's no secret that the courts are going broke, and so they're looking to charge poor people for the cost of prosecuting them. And can you imagine if you're acquitted and they're going to charge you for the time they put you in jail, or charge you for the cost of a lawyer? And what's happening, for example, in New Orleans is that if you are appointed a public defender, you have to pay something like $40 or $50. And then if you're convicted, you have to pay an additional public defender fee. And they're using that money to fund the public defender's office. So it puts the lawyer in a quandary, is that you have to either, you know, if you win the case and the client's acquitted, they don't have to pay the public defender fee, so you're not going to get paid. So on that next case, you're not going to have the resources you need to fight that case. It places lawyers in a terrible situation. The other situation that we see is flat fees. Attorneys that are paid $100 to handle a misdemeanor case, regardless of whether it goes to trial, or $400 for a felony case. What happens? Those clients get pled guilty because that's the most efficient way for the lawyer to deal with that case.
And Lawrence, a listener, Eric, who couldn't stay, said, it's not a fair comparison between the budgets of the DA and the public defender, since there are other private defense attorneys that also face off against the DA. Can you just respond to Eric?
Well, we do about 80% of all the cases, so I think it's a fair comparison. And I think, relatively speaking, we're not funded on a parity or an equal basis with the district attorney. Sure, the district attorney has to review some cases that they don't file on, and there are private lawyers, but we do 80 to 85% of the cases.
And let's go to Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. Good morning. I was listening to the program, and having been through the criminal justice system in Santa Cruz, I am thoroughly disgusted with it. And I told my attorney after an event that he wanted to get a declaration of innocence, but I figured why bother. I went into a situation where the DA falsified evidence. They didn't bother to vet what the person accusing me of the crime. The police officer falsified his report as well. And then one day while I'm sitting in court, I did hire an attorney because I considered the possibility of a public defender, and I was very uncomfortable with things I had heard. And one day while I'm waiting in court, a fellow next to me was, I asked him the circumstances, and he told them to me. He had a public defender. He did not believe he was guilty. The defender believed he ought to plead guilty, and he didn't want to. And since they were trying to force me to plead, I found this curious. So while we're sitting there, his defender walked up to him. They exchanged a few words, and he said, you know, I don't want to plead guilty. And his defender said to him, F you. And I was astonished at the disrespect.
So, Linda, it sounds like your question is, how much pressure is put on defendants, even those who say that they are not guilty, to plead because of the caseload of attorneys and because of the system that we have?
And that's terrible. I'm sorry that happened to you. And, you know, I hope you reported that, because if one of my staff did that, and I'm sure Larry's the same way, I mean, we would want to know, because that is unconscionable. The reality is that the system places a lot of pressure on people accused of crime, you know, to plead guilty. They'll penalize people for going to trial. They'll keep people in jail because they don't plead guilty. This is a reality, and it's a dirty secret of our criminal justice system, and it's something that we have to guard against.
And Lawrence, Linda's in your county. Yeah, I'm asking you to do that.
We have three law firms that provide indigent defense services, and I'm the main contractor. And if there's conflicts, there are two other law firms that take the conflict indigent defense service cases. If that was my firm, and I don't know that it was, I would hope someone would complain to me, because I would take care of business, because that story, if true, is unacceptable.
And is Linda still with us? Can we hear from her?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I don't know the fellow's name. I would recognize him if I saw him. And the thing is, though, I wonder what, and I appreciate Lawrence's response in this regard, but, you know, I have a situation going on where I haven't been able to have any anything that I've been experiencing further investigated, and this goes back to the original part about why I was in court. But you know, the whole system to me with the district attorney, that they have so much discretion to push people in a direction. Even the fact that they hear when there's a record amount of people needing trials, and Bob Lee issues a press release, emergency caseload, and I'm somebody there who has done, it's a little piddly thing that some people couldn't even figure out why I was there, but his office pushed it. So I see that they abuse the system, and I was there originally because the judge that I first saw would not let me speak in my defense. And this had to do with a restraining order hearing.
So Linda, we should probably not go too deep into the details of your particular case, but it sounds like Lawrence is willing to hear your complaints and wants to do that. So thank you so much. Let me ask you, Lawrence.
Yeah, Linda should call me. Call me directly this afternoon or tomorrow.
That sounds great. Thank you, Linda. So Lawrence is asking you to call him. So the adversarial system that we've set up, the way that we've set this up, it seems like you're penalized if you do try to go to trial, if you don't plead. Is that accurate, Lawrence?
Yeah, I think the legislature over the last 20 years has given godlike power to the DAs, and it makes it very difficult for certain felonies to go to trial, because if they do and lose, the consequences with enhancements and priors and the charge themselves can be literally life in prison. So they have godlike power, not always godlike wisdom, and it's up to us to get the other side of the story through thorough investigation, aggressive law in motion, and try to play with the cards we're dealt in a very effective way. But it's tough right now because of the sanctions that people face.
And that's Lawrence Bigham. He's the public defender of Santa Cruz County. We're also speaking with Jeff Adachi, who's the public defender in San Francisco. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the right to a speedy and fair trial, which is embedded in the Constitution and upheld by the Supreme Court in Gideon in 1963. And we're asking the question if it actually works in practice, because as Lawrence said, it's essentially an unfunded mandate. So if you're somebody who has questions about this or has had experience with the criminal justice system, you can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let me read this email. We were de facto parents for an infant who had a public defender in Alameda County, and his case worked its way through juvenile court. It took 3 years until the parental rights were revoked and we were able to adopt him. During this time, the public defender's caseload was so enormous that we only saw him in court. The public defender never visited the client at our home, nor had us bring him to the office. We felt this hampered our son's defense and advocacy. That was 11 years ago. Have things changed in the way that public defenders work with juvenile clients and de facto parents?
Yes, it has. Is it better everywhere? No. I'm sure you would still hear that same story in some places, unfortunately. But, for example, in our office, the juvenile division, is very well resourced. We make sure that the attorneys there are trained. Years ago, people that were sent to the juvenile division were often people who were burned out or tired, working in the adult cases, and it was often the case that the representation wasn't very good. And I know in Alameda County, Brandon Woods, who's a public defender there, has worked to really improve the representation that they provide in the dependency cases. But one thing that's very important when you start looking at how these systems operate, when the public defender's office is underfunded and can't do their job, the entire system suffers because you're not able to move these cases. That's a horrible story of having to wait years and years and years in order to get an outcome because the attorney didn't have time, to prepare the case properly. We don't want a justice system in this country that's like that.
And what constitutes a speedy trial? We read an article in Fusion about a young man named Ralph Berry who was arrested for a crime he didn't commit, but he spent 3 years in prison on Rikers Island from the ages 19 to 22, waiting for a trial. He's free now. He was cleared of the charges, but he lost this big chunk of his life. What constitutes a speedy trial, and are defendants getting that?
Well, in some states, there are statutes, like in California, that says in a misdemeanor case, if you're in jail, you have to have a trial within 30 days if you refuse to what they call waive time or agree to a trial outside those timelines. And in a felony case, it's 60 days after you've been held to answer after a preliminary hearing, which is a probable cause hearing. So you have those rights. In other places, you don't have any actual time limit. So in terms of when they set your trial, it could be a year. There's been horror stories I've heard about people waiting for years and years and not being able to go to trial because there's no lawyer. So in terms of what a speedy trial means, it depends on where you are. And
there's a tension, though, Jeff, between a speedy trial and a well-prepared trial. And in certain felonies, sex and violence cases, you really want a well-prepared trial. And therefore, some people are willing to waive their right to a speedy trial. But 3 years, that's absurd. But that could be a function of a public defender system with too many cases.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Let's go to Ron in San Francisco. Hi, Ron. Welcome to your call.
Hi there. I'm really concerned about the fact that it seems that both defenders and prosecutors work for the same law firm. Both of you work for the county. You kind of have the same work rules. You belong to the same unions. And how does that jive with the idea that you're supposed to have an adversary position? It seems to me that that can go a long way to railroading people who need a great defense.
Thanks, Ron. Yeah.
And you raise a good point. I mean, one of the criticisms that is levied against public defenders is that we're dump trucks or that we don't care about our clients or we get a paycheck regardless of, you know, whether we do a good job or not. You know, could all those things be true? Yes. But it all comes down to making sure that you have an office which is zealous. If you look at our mission statement, you know, our mission statement is to be the most zealous, hard-fighting, compassionate criminal defense firm, and that's what we strive to be. And we require that our attorneys try cases regularly, that they file motions, that they do all the things that would be expected of a zealous lawyer. And so in terms of getting paid both by the county, you know, that's true. But at the same time, it depends on the culture in the office. If you have a culture where you're not going to stand up for your client, sure, that could happen. And you become buddy-buddy with the prosecutor and you're not advocating for your clients. In our office, it's just the opposite. We expect our attorneys to fight and our staff to fight, and they do.
Lawrence, do you have a comment on that idea of the adversarial?
Sure. Yeah. That stereotype has been out there since Gideon came down in 1963. And sort of my mission in life to remove that stereotype one case at a time. And that's done by, as Jeff just said, zealous advocacy and care for the client. My office is community-based, outside of the government center. It's no different from a private law firm. Ultimately, we're paid by the County of Santa Cruz, but we don't belong to the same union nor the same country clubs or whatever the other stereotype is. We sometimes work with the DAs, but I think we do a very good job, and our trial record and our law in motion record would reflect that. But I understand the perception, and all I can say is we need, as Jeff said, to create that culture of care and commitment to the client. And if the client comes first, we can slowly remove that perception one case at a time.
And we're running out of time here for your call. So I wanted to ask each of you about the prospect for reform and what your top three priorities each of you would be. And you have about a minute. Let's start with Lawrence and then we'll go to Jeff.
I think we need more federal funding. I mean, the reason I have a job is because the feds in the Sixth Amendment gave it to me and then Gideon is eloquent language, but we need more money to support that language as it's applied in our courtrooms on a daily basis. I also think there should be a California Public Defender Commission, which has some caseload standards and can look at some of the county systems around the state, which are really underfunded and not very independent, because, in fact, we speak truth to power and we need independence. And so I would like sort of a statewide commission to evaluate the quality of services around this state.
Let me go to Jeff because we just have another minute.
There's been some very positive developments in a number of jurisdictions. The Department of Justice has stepped in and said enough is enough, and it has actually said that the counties and the state have to begin funding public defense adequately. Secondly, we have to empower public defenders to say no when they have too many cases, because it's all about workload and caseload. And right now, many public defenders are afraid to say no more cases because they'll get fired. I'm elected, and so I can stand up, but others might not. Lastly, we need people who are being wronged by the criminal justice system to speak up. We're seeing many more programs on TV, news shows, talking about how people are being wrongfully convicted. We've had dozens and dozens of people in California and other places who have been wrongfully convicted of and sentenced to death. So we have to say enough is enough. We have to adequately and properly fund public defense, and people, everyday Americans, have to take a interest in not only the justice system in general, but how it affects the poorest people.
Well, thank you. Thank you both so much for joining us. That was Jeff Adachi. He's the public defender for San Francisco, and Lawrence Bigham is the public defender for Santa Cruz. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to put a link to web resources and information at our website. It's yourcallradio.org, and you can post comments there and other resources for listeners and continue this conversation there. I want to thank everybody who called, and I apologize that we couldn't get to all of your calls and emails. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What does the history of the biotech company Monsanto tell us about today's food system? On the next Your Call, we'll look back at Monsanto's beginnings and how the once chemical company grew to have such influence in our food system. This Saturday, protesters worldwide will rally in the March Against Monsanto. The movement to stop the spread of genetically modified crops is growing. So how are Monsanto and other biotech companies responding? Join the conversation with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.